Better Not Bigger, Reshaping the Economy, a talk about the steady state economy and how to get there, was given by Rob Dietz, the executive director of the Center for the Advancement of the Steady State Economy in Corvallis, Oregon, in May 2010.
Thanks for coming tonight on this gorgeous, warm evening. My name is Bruce Hecht, and with Maureen Beisel, we coordinate an organization called Natural Step Corvallis, and we work with Portland Natural Step to motivate and educate people about the principles of sustainability using the Natural Step framework. Our focus primarily has been on business and organizations, and we're also the founding organization for the Corvallis Sustainability Coalition. So tonight, I'm going to introduce our speaker, Rob Dietz. So Rob is the executive director of CASE, the Center for the Advancement of the Steady State Economy. And Rob currently lives in Corvallis. He's moved here 3 years ago from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Rob has experience in the public and private sectors working on solutions to natural resource problems using the tools of both economics and natural science. Rob recently added the Daily News to their website, named after the distinguished author and former senior World Bank economist Herman Daly. He's one of the key contributors to the blog. Rob has a master's degree from Virginia Tech in environmental science and engineering and an undergraduate degree in economics and environmental studies from the University of Pennsylvania. So we'll welcome Rob.
Thanks, Bruce. Well, thanks a lot for coming out tonight, and thanks to the Natural Step for inviting me, Bruce and Maureen, and the work they're doing is outstanding, so I hope everyone will support what they're doing with their efforts. I am here to talk a little bit tonight about economic growth and the steady state economy. The title of this talk is Better, Not Bigger, Reshaping the Economy for a Finite World. And I want to start with a little story. You know, each fall at one of America's oldest universities, there's a pretty large portion of the freshman class that enrolls in Econ 101. And the night before the first midterm exam, when these students probably should be tucked away in the library studying their demand and supply curves, they actually start to gather in the main quadrangle. It's kind of late in the evening, you know, more students keep kind of gathering into this place, and pretty soon the windows are opening up and students are all looking out over this gathering horde. And electricity kind of starts to build through the crowd as the hour approaches midnight. It goes kind of quiet as midnight gets there, and then suddenly a backwards countdown starts, sort of like New Year's Eve at Times Square. You know, you hear the 10, 9, 8, and at midnight, the econ scream begins. Everybody starts yelling, pandemonium breaks out, people are literally going, "I hate econ!" You see a lot of people shirtless, running around, grunting, and just as quickly as this thing begins, it sort of ends in eerie silence, and everyone goes home. Well, the question that I have is, you know, what causes students to build up and then blow off steam in this manner? You know, it could be, you know, they're sort of nervous being freshmen taking one of their first exams, but I think it has a lot to do with the lack of connection between what they're learning in economics and their real-world experiences. It's a difficult subject for a lot of students because of that. And this econ scream is sort of a minor example of that attitude in students. A much more readily noticeable attitude happened not too long ago. I think it was in the year 2000 in France. A bunch of students created this open letter, and they sent it to their professors with a quote that said, "We no longer want to have this autistic science imposed upon us." And they actually formed a movement called the Post-Autistic Economics Movement. And this actually got a lot of press in France. It created something of a media frenzy, enough that it started skipping around the world, across the ocean, went over into England from Cambridge, England to Cambridge, Massachusetts. And, you know, so these students were realizing something's not quite right with economics. So college students around the world have figured that something isn't quite going the way it ought to be, both the way it's taught, but also the way we practice it on the streets. And I want to talk about that, especially when it comes to economic growth. And that's really one take-home point of this talk tonight is there's something wrong with our pursuit of economic growth. But don't worry, I don't want to just give a critique. That's maybe easy enough to do, but we need more than that. You know, so I want to assure you that I plan to provide an alternative vision for the economy. You know, when Martin Luther King wanted to make a big social change, what did he say? I mean, he faced all kinds of hardships, thorny problems along the way. But he didn't say, I have a nightmare, right? He said, I have a dream. And, you know, I'd like to talk a little bit about what would our dream economy be? What's the proper framework for sustainability? So that's really take-home point number two, that there is a better way to run the economy. Okay, I want to dive in with kind of some real general stuff. I want to just talk about growth for a second. These are the top two definitions of Webster's dictionary for the verb to grow: to spring up and develop to maturity, and to increase in size. And you can see the first one actually kind of implies an end to growth. You know, you go from growth to maturity. The word growth itself has very positive connotations in the English language. You know, you often hear it with phrases like spiritual growth or personal growth. But I think in those cases, we're confusing growth and development. Of course, you have negative connotation as well. You can hear the phrases malignant growth. But by and large, we've confused growth and development. Growth really means getting bigger. It's about increasing size, increasing scale. The real question is, how do you tell when growth is desirable or not? And you really got to look at three things. You have to look at what is the thing, the entity that is actually growing, what's the context for that growth, and what's the rate of growth. What are we talking about when we talk about economic growth? And this is where I think in the news you always hear, oh, the economy's growing, good. Oh, the economic growth, excellent. But no one really stops and looks at those three facets of it. So here's what's actually growing when we talk about economic growth. If we're talking about increasing production and consumption of goods and services. And we typically measure that with a term called gross domestic product, or GDP, which is just the final dollar, it's the dollar value of the goods and services that are produced. And the things that actually drive growth in the economy are increasing population, increasing consumption per person, or a combination of those two. So that's what we're talking about, economic growth. Very clear definitions. That's what you'll see in an economics textbook as well. Well, I want to take a quick turn and look at those components of economic growth, population and consumption. I don't know if any of you have ever heard of or read anything by Albert Bartlett. He's a physicist. He has an interesting quote where he said, "The greatest shortcoming of the human race is our inability to understand the exponential function." I like stories and personal examples that bring these points home. And my best friend growing up lived down the street from me. And first time I went over to his house in second grade, I noticed there's all these portraits of presidents lined up on their wall, and they're all signed. And so I asked him about it, and it turned out that his brother, who was a few years older than us, he had been born in 1967, and he came into the world as the 200 millionth American. He was on the cover of Life magazine. So each year on his birthday, the president would send him a birthday card with a signed picture. And then, you know, so he was kind of this minor celebrity at birth, but then that story went away. Well, I saw him again on the news in the fall of 2006, and the reason was that the 300 millionth American was about to be born, and so the news was kind of pulling out these old stories on the 200 millionth. And it really struck me, in the course of maybe one generation or even less than that, the United States had grown 100 million people. Regardless of what you think about the resource use of that population, that's significant. You know, it's at least food for thought. Let's look at the other side, consumption. There's a lot of other people and organizations that do a really nice job of talking about consumption. One of my favorites is the video, The Story of Stuff. We have a lot of ironies in our society surrounding it. We're kind of locked in this psychology of always needing to consume more. And when you start, kind of thinking about it and looking around, these ironic, I don't know what to call them, episodes or examples present themselves all over the place. I went to the doctor, and as I was waiting, there was an Oprah magazine in the office, and I took this picture of it because it was great. It has this yellow banner across it that says, "Declutter your life. It's time to simplify things. Oprah's starting with her closet." I should say her very ample closet, too. But the amazing part about this was the little asterisk next to that. "Her bags, her shoes, your chance to bid and win. O's great online auction." So declutter her life, but clutter everyone else's through the auction. One of the points about growing consumption is that we've, in some ways, confused it with growing fulfillment. As you increase your consumption, if you're starting from zero, of course you get fulfillment out of that. We want to eat. That's a good thing. And as you continue to increase your consumption, you can establish comfort in your life, also a good thing. But over time, if you continue consuming more and more, we find that as we get into luxury and extravagance, that fulfillment actually decreases. It's an important relationship to keep in mind as we consider growing in consumption. So we know what's growing when the economy's getting bigger, right? GDP, population, consumption. What's the context for that growth? The context is, in kind of the big picture, that's it. All economic activity, everything associated with it, occurs here on our rather large but quite finite planet. That context has major implications for how big the economy can actually grow. And it really comes to us from the laws of physics. There's two basic laws of physics that apply to the planet and to every subsystem of the planet, including the economy. The first would be the conservation law. It tells us that matter and energy can't be created or destroyed. The basic is that everything that goes into the economy comes from somewhere, and everything we produce in the economy goes somewhere. So you've got resources that come in, and you've got wastes that go out. The second law tells us that material and energies tend to degrade over time, degrade in quality. That's why an engine can't be 100% efficient. It's why metals rust. It's why we age. In an economy, that means that we use high-quality inputs, both in the energy and the material side, and in the end, we get low-quality materials and energy as outputs. One of the big issues with that is, of course, as the economy grows, this subsystem, as it grows, we have to take more and more resources and start brushing up against limits there. And then on the other side, we brush up against limits in the assimilative capacity to absorb our wastes. So that's one of the key contexts for our economic growth. Another one has to do with the concept of carrying capacity, which tells you how much of an activity a given place can support. Early on, when the economy was rather small, we had lots of nature and little built stuff. And as you grow the economy, that exactly changes. We get lots of built stuff and much less nature. Early on, our ability to impinge on the world, that was the limiting factor to economic growth. Now the limiting factor to economic growth is the availability of those natural resources. So that's another piece of the context. One other context when thinking about GDP growth or economic growth is looking at poverty. It is true that economic growth has decreased the percentage of people in the world in poverty, but we now have, in absolute numbers, more people living in poverty than at any time in human history. Economic growth has not really enabled us to manage our poverty problem. Okay, so just to summarize, we know what's growing: GDP, population, consumption. We've got some context for that growth that occurs on this planet. We know what it means in some human terms. What about the rate of increase? World GDP increasing from recorded history, from the year zero up to current times. And the growth rate over this is about 4% per year. Recently, there was a New York Times article that ran a story about economic growth and recovery, and it touted this 3.5% rate of increase for U.S. GDP. And this was for the third quarter of 2009. So they were getting really excited, like, oh, we're recovering from this recession. We're coming out of it. The article quoted the chief U.S. economist for Goldman Sachs, a guy by the name of Jan Hatzius, and he had this quote. He said, "The big picture perspective is that things have improved. The question is, how sustainable is this growth going forward?" Of course, he means, you know, how do we keep this growth rate amped up at 3.5%? Not the bigger question of, is it physically or ecologically sustainable to grow at 3.5%? Well, you know, I was thinking about it. A 3.5% growth rate translates into a 20-year doubling time. So we're talking in 20 years doubling the size of the economy, twice as much stuff, twice as many goods and services. So the real question is, can we produce and consume twice as much 20 years from now as we are today? And that's what the chief economists of the Goldman Sachs, those kinds of folks, are cheerleading exactly that outcome. So that brings us to the, you know, we've got the what's growing, we've got the rate, we've got the context, so that can give us more of a picture about the desirability of growth. My conclusion is that growth might not be desirable, but really the conclusion is it certainly deserves consideration among our politicians, business people, journalists, or people teaching economics. We really need to be looking at those facets of growth and make that decision very pointedly. That issue about the desirability of growth then brings me to what I call the really, really big dilemma. And I don't know if folks have seen this book called Prosperity Without Growth by Tim Jackson. It's a really good book, and what I like about it is it lays out this really, really big dilemma very, very well. What he talks about is, on the one hand, economic growth is unsustainable. You know, we've got problems on the input side with, you know, using up resources. We've got the rising environmental costs associated with it. We have profound disparities in social well-being. But on the other hand, when growth stops, we have some problems with instability. We get rising unemployment and this downward spiral of recession. And that's a huge concern, right? So it seems kind of like this impossible situation. It's this huge dilemma, but we certainly can't avoid it. We can't hide from it. So what are our options? What can we do? Well, I was thinking about the strategy for solving the big dilemma. You've got two sides of it. Economic growth is unsustainable. Failure to grow is destabilizing. Typically, when you got a big dilemma like this, you choose one side as being true, and then you try to kind of modify or fix the other side. Well, what we've been doing, you know, with the politicians and mainstream economists and journalists and just about everybody has been doing, is we've been focusing on that side as being the true side. We can't fail to grow. We've got to keep growth going. And therefore, we tend to say, well, okay, how can we make economic growth somehow sustainable? And the main argument for trying to do that revolves around technological progress, and this idea of decoupling. Now, decoupling simply means that we'll have our economic growth, but somehow we'll use fewer energy and material resources as we do that. And, you know, those are very attractive ideas. The question is, can we do it? Is it real? This comes out of Tim Jackson's book again. He calls it The Myth of Decoupling. He's actually taken a look at the numbers. World GDP rising in the energy. You've got CO2 emissions, usage of coal, natural gas, and oil. And they're all rising together. We're not really decoupling our use of energy from the growth that we experience in the economy. He does the same thing with materials, with minerals, iron, copper, nickel. So we're not really seeing this decoupling actually occurring in the economy. There's another piece of technology, too, that I've been looking into a little bit lately, and this is my, I call it sort of the breathing room thesis, and it has to do with the cycle of growth and technology. And it goes like this. When we have economic growth, you know, this increasing population and consumption, we're naturally going to run into limits. Anything that's growing hits limits. Could be that dwindling resource base, for example. But we're smart. We're clever. I mean, people have been talking about the limits to growth for ages. Malthus, probably most famously, and in a lot of ways, people like that have been discredited. But some of what they've argued has also been borne out. You know, we're clever. We come up with ways to kind of push those limits. We'll develop new technology. And probably the best example of that would be the Green Revolution. You know, we were facing starvation, famine, you know, very severe problems. And we figured out some agricultural technologies to get past that. But what did we do next? Well, you know, we got some breathing room from that. And how did we use our breathing room? Well, of course, for more growth. The next time through the cycle, your limits to growth become more profound. You know, instead of local limits, you may end up with global limits. You know, we're looking at possible climate disruption now. And your technological methods for dealing with those problems become more complex. You know, we have to get more and more ingenious as we continue through this cycle. So, in effect, our technological progress and our using it for economic growth, that's eating into our breathing room rather than giving us more breathing room. And one final note about technology is appropriate use of technology. It is unclear that we are capable of using technology for sustainability. The jury is out on that one. So that brings me to taking a different look at how to employ that strategy to solve the big dilemma. So, big dilemma. Side one, economic growth is unsustainable. Failure to grow is destabilizing. Maybe we believe that economic growth is unsustainable and that the term sustainable growth is an oxymoron. If we start from there, what can we do to make a non-growing economy stable and healthy? And that's really what my job is about at CASI. You know, how do we make this transition to a non-growing economy? How do we reshape our economy so that we're aiming for better, not bigger? And this is the start of the happy part of the presentation. The aim of a steady state economy is really four things that we want to achieve with it. One is we want sustainable scale. You don't want the size of the economy to be impinging on the planet's ability to generate life-supporting services. A second critical piece is fair distribution of wealth. You can imagine if we're not growing the pie infinitely, we better start thinking about how to divide up the pieces. So having some kind of fair way to do that is critical. A third piece is we want to have efficient allocation of resources. This is something that, you know, markets tend to be pretty good at with certain types of goods and services, and we don't want to just throw that away. We'd like to use that where we can. And then a fourth part, of course, is high quality of life. That's sort of the point of the economy, is to help us lead high quality lives. And so what are the features of a steady state economy? Well, basically, we're talking about constant or maybe mildly fluctuating population. Same with consumption. And we got to figure out how to have a sustainable throughput or usage of energy and materials for that economy. What does it look like? Well, I've thrown some ideas up. We like to think of it as the Goldilocks size. Not too big, not too small, just right. Some of the ideas are that, you know, okay, yeah, we'd probably have a smaller population than the current world population that we have. We would have different measures of success. GDP would not be our ultimate marker. 3.5% growth would not necessarily tell us that we have a healthy economy. Some of the ones I like, shorter working hours, fewer status goods, better use of technology, you know, things like we would have less production, sort of less of the throwaway economy, and more maintenance, more durable economy. So, you know, we would have less fossil fuel-powered energy, less burning coal, and more from renewable sources. We'd certainly have less mountaintop mining and, you know, taking away the ecosystem services that were provided there. And we'd have more intact ecosystems that provide the services that we need. Less of the rat race and the stress, and, you know, more policies that allow us to have leisure time or, you know, time to develop interactions in community and family. Less of aisles packed with too many choices of stuff that we don't necessarily need, and more of just simplicity and enjoying what we have. less of globalized shipping, stacked containers in a shipping yard, less of that and more local interaction when you participate in marketplace activities, actually knowing who you're dealing with. I think Corvallis has a very nice seed of this going on, our food systems. You know, you can know your farmer, you can pass by the farmer's market on the way here tonight. Economy that's more personal and more lively. But the real question is, can we do it? Peter Victor is an ecological economist, and he's written a book called Managing Without Growth. He basically set out to answer that question, can we do it? His guidance, well, we have these other goals that we want to have. We want to get rid of poverty, we want to maintain employment, and we want to limit our throughput of energy and material. And I think he focused on his model on output of carbon dioxide. So basically, for the whole Canadian economy, he built this model and said, can we achieve those goals without growing the economy? And granted, it's just a model at this point. You know, they're not actually doing it. But he's showing that through some policy changes, yeah, we can have a non-growing economy that meets those criteria, that stabilizes CO2 emissions, that lowers the percentage of people in poverty, and has plenty of job opportunities for those who want them. In one of his main changes, he says we need to shorten our working hours, do more job sharing, more part-time possibilities. At least on a modeled level, looks like we can do it. So the question then becomes, okay, well, what policies are we going to need for this? The very first policy we need is to adopt the right goal. You know, we're not going to have a sustainable, a steady state economy, or whatever you want to call it, a green economy, a breathing room economy. We're not going to have that unless we want it, unless we're actually trying to achieve that instead of trying to achieve growth. You know, we're going to have to, as a society, as citizens, demand that as the right goal for the economy. One other policy that we need to pursue is to make sure that we've got exemplary conservation lands that actually are representative of the ecosystem services out there. You can find the big working list and some other policy ideas on our website, which is steadystate.org. A couple of them can apply to the scale of Corvallis, and that we could, you know, we and other communities could kind of start to pilot some of these things. You know, like the conservation areas is one, and Corvallis is pretty good about that. I think we care a lot about our open space and about maintaining natural areas. Going down to my favorite again, the more flexible working day, week, and year, I think that's another one that a community can say, yeah, let's try to make this happen. Let's figure out what we can do with job sharing, with part-time work, and see how we can make it so that anybody that wants a job can get one. Another one is the idea of different measures of progress. I've been working with Bruce on an economic action team. It's part of the Sustainability Coalition. So the question is, you know, how do we measure ourselves? How do we know Corvallis' economy is getting better? You know, if we use standard economic measurements, we could be sort of becoming, at least on paper, wealthier, but actually making ourselves poorer. So we're throwing around the idea of developing a separate set of indicators. There are towns across the U.S. and across the world that are kind of preparing themselves to have a more localized economy. So, you know, okay, after we go through, here's what a steady state economy is, and here's, yes, it can be done, and here are some policies. The next question that always follows that is, well, what can I do? And I've got a few answers for that as well. Number one is you can publicly voice your opinion. One way to do that is to sign our position on economic growth. And of course, there are many other ways to voice your opinion as well. A second thing you can do is get informed. We're trying to keep good resources on our website to help you with that. And Bruce mentioned our relatively new blog, The Daily News. We're getting some pretty high-quality essays from Herman Daly and from Brian Check and Brent Blackwelder, and I'm trying to keep up with them as well. And I've got some of the books, of course, my personal favorite right there, The Lorax. Another thing that you can do is you can get involved more with CASI. You can become a member. You can become an outreach volunteer and help spread the message. You can be the person standing up here giving a talk. Another thing you can do is think and act like a steady stater. I know many of you already do, but it's basically about living, consuming responsibly so that we can meet our own needs, but so that there's enough left over for the next generation as well. And a fifth thing you can do is ask a lot of questions. We've got one part of our website that has some sample questions that you can ask a professor of economics or somebody who is promoting economic growth without having considered, what's growing, the context of that growth, and the rate of growth. Our friends at Adbusters like to ask lots of questions. They've got this sticker that they mean for you to place on your econ textbook. And it says, it's for entertainment purposes only. Yeah, they're pretty good provocateurs over there. Okay, so I hope I've convinced you that at least there's a problem with economic growth and that we may have a better framework. What I want to talk about for the last few minutes here is kind of what we're up against when it comes to this embedded belief or faith in economic growth. Many of you probably have heard of E.F. Schumacher. He's one of the economists who's responsible for this kind of thinking, and he was a brilliant writer as well. He wrote the book Small is Beautiful, but he also wrote this other little book called A Guide for the Perplexed. And he opens it with this story about a map. We all use maps and models to make sense of the world. That helps us deal with the complexity out there and figure out what it is we want to do. But there's a danger when that map doesn't really fit reality. This is what he says in the opening pages of that book. He says, on a visit to Leningrad some years ago, I consulted a map to find out where I was, but I could not make it out. From where I stood, I could see several enormous churches, yet there was no trace of them on my map. When finally an interpreter came to help me, he said, we don't show churches on our map. It then occurred to me that this was not the first time I had been given a map which failed to show many things I could see right in front of my eyes. All through school and university, I had been given maps of life and knowledge on which there was hardly a trace of many of the things that I most cared about and that seemed to me to be of the greatest possible importance to the conduct of my life. When a map and reality part ways, you essentially have two choices. You can make a new map, or you can deny or somehow try to mold reality to fit the map that you have and keep it. I think what we see most often in the world is people selecting choice number two. It's very difficult to overcome an ingrained mental model. It's really nothing short of a paradigm shift that we're talking about here. Perhaps Copernicus would empathize with us when we're talking about the shift from economic growth to sustainability. People held on to that idea of the Earth-centered universe for as long as they could, even as more and more evidence poured in to support the sun-centric universe. And you see that a lot with economic growth as well. And I have to admit, I was involved in some mental gymnastics when I was first introduced to this concept. I find it kind of surprising that I'm standing here today giving this talk. Brian Check was the one who first approached me with the idea of a steady state economy. And I was interested, but pretty skeptical. I read his book, which is outstanding, and I got to say, I was one of the students at that econ scream, right? I was yelling, I hate econ, and still majored in it anyways. But I realized something was wrong with economics, and I just wasn't able to put my finger on it. And even after being told this idea about economic growth and the problems with it, I still had trouble. And I literally had the fortune to meet Herman Daly at a conference that I went to. And it turned out he had just finished writing with his colleague Josh Farley this book, textbook, on ecological economics. And I bought the thing and read it cover to cover. What a weird thing to do. But the whole time I'm going, yeah, oh! And I was thinking, this should be the Econ 101 textbook because it puts things in the right context. And that was when I was able to kind of crumple up my old map for the economy and grab the new map, and I guess you could say Herman Daly is the cartographer on that map. And I feel like I've been navigating much more accurately ever since. I kind of want to finish with another little story, but it starts with Kenneth Boulding. He wrote this outstanding essay a bunch of years ago. He was kind of the renegade economist. He wrote this essay called The Economics of the Coming Spaceship Earth. And in it, he said we need to shift from our expansionist consumptive economy, which he called a cowboy economy, and have an economy that takes conservation more seriously, something that he called the spaceman or astronaut economy, you know, consumes wisely within the limits of the spaceship. So the story I want to finish with, I think it provides a fitting metaphor for that shift. Most of you probably know the story of Apollo 13. You know, an explosion damaged the capsule. It was on a mission to the moon, had three astronauts in it, and basically their lives were in grave danger, and they had to figure out with their colleagues back in Houston how to get home safely. I think there was one scene in it that, to me, was really powerful, and it's the scene at ground control. They realize that the spaceship is taking on too high of a concentration of carbon dioxide, maybe not unlike our planet. And so they got to figure out, how do we filter this out? And the engineers have this box of material that's available on the spaceship, and they dump it all out on the table, and they say, okay, we got, whatever, half an hour. Here's the materials and the tools. Let's figure this out. Let's make a square peg fit into a round hole. And they get to work going on this thing, and they actually make a filter. And, you know, to make the long story short, they did fit their square peg into that round hole, and they brought this crew home safely. The idea behind it is that they had this very valid and pressing goal. They had limited energy and materials to work with, but they were able to use their creativity to get to this desired end. And we need to do the same thing when we're talking about the economy. We need to have the right goal, this sustainable economy that provides well-being for everyone without undermining our life support systems. We need to recognize our material and our energy limits, and we need to harness our creativity to achieve desired ends for all citizens. The limits to economic growth are real, and the desirability of economic growth has become suspect, especially in those countries that are already consuming a lot. But you got to remember, the economy is a completely human construct. You know, it consists of us and our institutions, right? We built it. And there's no cosmic rule that says that it has to get bigger. It's truly what we make of it. So I'd like to say, let's get busy and transform the economy into one that can provide true prosperity over the long haul. It's really about development, as I've said, not growth. We want to create an economy that works for people and the planet. So let's work towards a steady state economy that gets us better instead of bigger. Thank you. I'm happy to answer, or at least try to answer, any questions.
The one thing that I don't think you really talked about was the idea or the concept that the money that we have is actually decoupled from the goods and things that we make. And one of the real problems is that every time interest is paid for anything, and by interest I mean our savings interest. When we make money off our savings, or we expect to put savings in the bank and expect to get something more back from that, or money is loaned out from a banker to someone who makes something and then is expected to pay back money so that the banker can make a living and we can pay all our credit union people and stuff like that, that requires the growth of the money source. That's the major thing that is driving them to continually drive us into consuming more, and what built the housing bubble. And I think that's one thing that would be really good to talk about.
No, it's a good point. The idea that our monetary system is structured for growth is exactly right. And it does drive the idea that we've got to grow. And the real reason is very simple. Money is not wealth. It's a claim on wealth, right? I mean, we can have a whole stack of money. It's meaningless unless we all agree that it can be exchanged for some level of real wealth. Real wealth is just that, real, and it does not necessarily grow exponentially. In fact, those laws of physics would say that over time it degrades. Our claims on wealth, the money, we've set it up such that they do grow exponentially. So if you can't keep your real wealth growing to keep up with the rate at which your claims on wealth, your money, grows, eventually your monetary system will collapse.
A quick story and then a question.
Sure.
You mentioned 1967. In 1967, I was taking a health class required at OSU at the time. Mm-hmm. The teacher said to us, And it's one thing that really stuck with me. And he said, there's one thing, I don't care what else you get out of this class, but understand that in your lifetime, the biggest challenges you're going to face is human population growth. I think we all know when you look at the exponential curve that population needs to be controlled. But I guess my question to you is, what kind of stumbling blocks do you see from religion as it affects controlling population?
Well, you know, there's all kinds of stumbling blocks. The issue of population has become exceedingly thorny. I mean, my experience has been that environmental NGOs won't really touch it, and it's because of the political unpopularity of it. The whole idea to me is that we need to figure out how to stabilize population with the least amount of impingement, the least, I don't like even the term control population because it brings up these negative connotations, but study after study that I've seen talks about the main way to work on stabilizing population is empowerment of women. So yeah, I mean, there will be issues, but I think the key thing is to make it okay again to talk about this. It's a tough problem, and maybe it's not fun to talk about, but that's really the key. We seem to have lost our ability, whether it's NGO world or politicians, to really even give it a fair airing.
Well, I'd like to applaud you for that. It's a great idea and noble goal. One concern of mine is, like you mentioned, this goal of fairer distribution of wealth. And, I mean, I don't know if you noticed, but we're going the other way, right? Mm-hmm. Greater and greater concentration of wealth. And I'm also thinking of that's a great goal. I mean, I work a short week and telecommute, but yeah. I mean, shorter work hours are great, by the way. So that's a great goal, but in actual fact, real wages are going down and it's harder and harder to make a living wage. And when you were talking about that, I was just flashing on a scene from our last illustrious president, Mr. Bush, where he's in a town hall or something and some woman comes up to say something and she's working two or three jobs and he's like, isn't that great, you know, only in America? Right. Like, yeah, that's a great thing that we've got, you know, single mothers working two or three jobs to, you know, to feed their families. So My question is, how do we even arrest that, let alone turn it towards what you want? And especially, like you say, this isn't even a conversation among policymakers and politicians. So how do we create that?
Right. That's a really valid question. I mean, this idea of discrepancy in wealth, you know, you can come up with policies to deal with that pretty easily. You know, you could have a minimum income and a maximum income. You could have inheritance taxes going up. There are many ways that we already know of to handle it, but they're politically unpopular. How do we do it? I mean, the best thing I can say is that we start demanding it. And part of that is changing the culture of consumption and, I don't know, what I would call kind of a manipulation of the American dream. Now, I'll say this. There's nothing easy about trying to make this transition. There's nothing that will be easy about convincing people that the goal needs to be different and actually trying to implement the policies will be difficult. I mean, we have an economy structured for growth. We've got to start dismantling that structure and changing it into something else.
So the more I begin to learn about economics and just these institutions we work in, we're forced to work through a dollar market. So whether you're doing something great, dollars still drive the market. And we would all here agree that environmental economics is really important and we should prioritize environmental economics. And I'm a college student. I happen to be in an environmental economics class. And our textbook is a microeconomics textbook. My one problem with that comes actually from reading Herman Daly's book, Beyond Growth. When we look at environmental economics, we're not focusing on macroeconomics. My problem with that is we live in a fully globalized world. Yes, we can prioritize local, but we will forever deal in markets. We will forever deal in these massive global markets. And so we need a dollar or some sort of like economic number to trade in these globalized markets. So Daly talks about environmental macroeconomics. But the one thing I'm trying to now begin to wrap my head around is we have no foundation for environmental macroeconomics because people aren't talking about these scales of resource consumption or waste assimilation back into the environment. And so I'm asking you, an engineer and an economist, how do we create a foundation to begin talking about environmental macroeconomics so people on these large globalized scales can now have an understanding of the scalability of these issues?
Yeah. Well, that's a question that puts me on the spot. I have one way of ducking it, actually, which is to say that right now we have a huge workforce that is propping up the system you're talking about. You know, financiers, economists, you know, lots of people that are involved in trying to make their bucks off of growing the global market. I mean, there's been a lot written about how the smartest students from college go and get jobs at Goldman Sachs because it would, you know, it's respected or was respected, and they make tons of money. So one of the things that I would like to, you know, see happen, and I'm not sure how to get the ball rolling on this, but if we can convince ourselves and the powers that be that the macroeconomic goal needs to change, we could unleash all of those great minds into figuring out how to build up this structure that we need. Another piece of it, I think, is changing what we're taught. I mean, kind of like you said, your environmental microeconomics book, it teaches you some cool ways to analyze things economically. But like you said, it's not until you read a Herman Daly or someone else who can kind of slam the big picture home that you begin to change your thinking on this. Well, maybe we could be taught that worldview from the beginning.
I saw your chart of happiness index versus mm-hmm. GDP. And I noticed that sitting at the very top of the happiness index was Iceland. A very poor country, incidentally, a very difficult place to live. There's a story. Iceland was hit the first and the hardest in the financial collapse because their banks had gone completely wild. And the Icelanders responded first by overthrowing the government, mostly by throwing yogurt. It's a small country. And extremely civilized. They overthrew the government, but they did overthrow the government, and then they held an election. And the outcome of the election was that the Green Party became a major party and is now half of the government. It's in a coalition. So my next question is, where are we going to get the political will to make the kind of changes in the economy that you're talking about?
I would start with the yogurt farmers. Yeah, I mean, where are we going to get the political will? That's a good question. I mean, if I had a ready answer for that, I'd be out there doing it. I mean, this is currently my answer to it. Try to convince as many people as I can that this is the direction we need to move. I think we need to get more clever about the messaging. You know, it's not a fun message to hear. The collapse is coming. You know, you just get labeled as a doomsayer. But I suspect that a few more crises, tough times will come our way, and those are the times of real change, right? I mean, it's actually funny. Milton Friedman, who's probably, you know, he would think this stuff is garbage, you know, sort of the free market. Yeah, exactly. University of Chicago economist. He had this great quote, said something along the lines of, you know, it's only in times of crisis that real change occurs, and the change that does occur depends on the ideas that are lying around. So I see the role of developing this political will. What I'm trying to do is make this idea of a steady state economy lying around there on the desk of the people who are in charge and those who might replace them when that crisis comes.
Well, first of all, thanks for your talk. I really appreciate it. It's a piece of the picture that's important and not talked about enough. I was interested in the list of bullet points that you had for what constitutes a steady state economy.
Okay.
And you stopped just before you talked about the different capital labor mix. And I was especially interested because it seems like aside from the cultural paradigm shift, like that would be the stumbling block is re-relating social classes.
Yeah.
So can you speak a little bit more about how different classes would relate to each other in the new economy like this?
I'll try. I mean, it's going to be speculation, but right. Talking about the labor capital mix, the idea behind that is, you know, the way the economy's been working is we've been replacing labor with capital. Mm-hmm. So that causes unemployment, which, as we know, is one of the things that makes us want to grow the economy. And it drives sort of the same thing that your question was about. It's one of these things that makes growth necessary, because mm-hmm. as we replace that labor with capital, now the economy's got to get bigger in order to find more jobs for those people. So the idea behind that would be not necessarily striving for that replacement. As for the social classes issue, you know, yeah, you're talking about, you know, we don't want to go back to some feudal system where there's a bunch of laborers working for the landlord or the king or whatever. And so A couple of things. I mean, the distribution of wealth policies, you would try to take care of that with minimum and maximum wealth and income. But it's basically you need to address disparity between the haves and the have-nots. Mm-hmm. And when you do that, you tend to eliminate some of that class problems.
So would you consider steady-state economics a labor movement? I mean, something to sort of like stabilize or equalize the relationship between capital and labor so that labor is not so dependent on capital?
I've never really characterized it that way, but yeah, I'd go out on a limb and say yeah. And there are many ideas out there, and you know, I'm not the source of them, Cassie. We tend to focus on the macroeconomic picture, but a lot of good work's being done on changing corporate structures, trying to work on worker-owned co-ops, you know, B corporations, yeah, and you know, triple bottom line kinds of ways of running a business. So, yeah, I mean, I think pushing some of those movements in step with what we're talking about with a steady state economy is something I'd like to see happen.
First, my question is, will we deviate away from an open and totally free economy? And assuming we don't deviate from a free economy, how are we going to talk about these things so we truly know the impacts that our economic actions are having? So if I buy corn ethanol that everybody's been hearing about, how do I know that it's actually been net positive for me to be driving on that corn ethanol? How do we talk about this?
Okay. That seems like two questions. Are we talking about moving away from an open and free economy? I mean, I guess that depends on your definition of open and free, but you know, I'm not in any way advocating that we turn to a communist style where we try to make everything a publicly owned resource and then dole it out. I mean, I think we've fairly well proved that that didn't work. But we certainly need to change our institutions. There's a really neat idea that Peter Barnes is promoting where he's trying to, and he's the guy that created the company Working Assets. He's trying to promote the commons sector to go along with the private sector and the public sector. And the idea there is that some of our resources are commons, like the atmosphere, and they ought to be owned by us commonly. And he basically talks about establishing trusts to manage those and to assign property rights for them and to manage them over the long term for everyone's benefit.
Would that be like a cap-and-trade CO2 market?
Well, I mean, that's one of the policies that Cassie recommends for limiting throughput, for example. You know, so you could say, well, yeah, maybe it means you can't pump out as much CO2 as your heart desires, so maybe they're less free in that regard, but perhaps you stabilize climate, so you're more free to actually live in an inhabitable world. So, you know, that's a question about freedom. You asked also, though, how do we talk about it? How do you know if what you're doing is actually, you know, sort of a net positive or is not harmful? A lot of that gets down to having better indicators, for one. You know, I would certainly like to see the ecological footprint be a major national level indicator that we watch just as closely as we watch reports of GDP or reports of the stock market.
In this country, in this culture, and other parts of the world, human beings always want to have some way of ordering themselves in the society and being important. And if we can redefine what important means, what, you know, the rewards for being good and productive in the society, then we can remove some of the money needs to be important. And sort of goes along with it. I find little difference between, say, a highly bureaucratic socialist or communist system and, say, an IBM corporation.
I don't disagree with that point. And I think there's a lot of room for improvement in corporate structure and how we operate business in this country. No question about it.
Just a quick question. But I mean, you mentioned before this college revolt, and I mean, it seems like this naturally belongs in like Econ 101 or something. So my question is, you know, what is Cassie or others doing to advocate for that? Is there anything we could do to assist that? I mean, we got a campus right here. That seems like a natural place for that to get us.
Yeah, I can't say we have a real big organized campaign or anything like that. Cassie is an extremely lean organization. In fact, you are speaking with the only paid employee right now. But any opportunity we get to speak to economists at a university, we do. And actually, the most popular textbook in econ classes now is by Gregory Mankiw. He's a Harvard economist. And we've actually talked with him, and I think he's considering the idea. The person who founded CASI, Brian Check, he actually asked him to sign our position statement. He has not done so yet. You know, I think a lot of it is personal inroads. I had it's kind of staged as a debate with one of the OSU economists. He's a real progressive economist. He's actually in their natural resource agricultural economics program. And, you know, it's just clear that all those years of schooling in thinking about economic growth as the answer to the problems, I can give him these arguments, but he doesn't really buy them. And I think until you take that worldview that the economy is a subsystem and it can't grow forever, you're not going to convince people to change their idea. So, you know, the way at it typically has been to try to go around it. Instead of hitting econ departments directly, we've been working largely in the ecological and conservation biology professional societies. But one piece of good news, Brian did get out to one of the kind of stodgy economics professional societies. I think it was the Eastern Economics Association or something like that. And Mankiw is actually the president of that. And he was extremely well received there. Got a whole bunch of economists to sign on. And you do see some departments that are kind of changing. There's a real progressive department at Tufts University that is really working on, you know, yeah, what kind of economy can we have that will be sustainable? So there's some rays of hope. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Better Not Bigger, Reshaping the Economy, a talk about the steady state economy and how to get there, was given in Corvallis, Oregon by Rob Dietz, Executive Director of the Center for the Advancement of the Steady State Economy. The talk was recorded by Joe Magner of Anabyte Electronics and Recording and was edited and produced by Roberta Hall.
Theme music was composed by Laurie Childers and played by Laurie Childers and Kent White.